Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Parents, this one's for you. Are any of you feeling just a teeny tiny bit anxious about back-to-school season? As you may have noticed, this is going to be a unique version of back to school. And for many of us, that means remote learning, which is a euphemism for the end of our patience as we knew it. With that in mind, what better time than now to call on a parenting coach? Yes, a parenting coach. That's where Megan Leahy comes in. Megan is the On Parenting columnist at the Washington Post, and she is the author of a new book that's called Parenting Outside the Lines, and it was published this week. Megan, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, your timing is impeccable. So before I turn this into a personal counseling session as the father of two teenagers, let me extend a call to all the parents listening today. What questions do you have about parenting? What have been your successes and challenges during this pandemic or just with parenting in general? If you'd like to participate in the conversation, tweet us at Charlotte Talks or email charlottetalks@wfae.org. Again, that's tweet us at Charlotte Talks or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. As I said, I'm going to take advantage of being in this chair today. This is my lone perk. And my self-absorption, Megan, extends to this, which is, and this is a question that I think a lot of other people are probably feeling. How in the hell are we going to do this remote learning thing again after we thought we had escaped it after the three-month trial that started in March? What in the world are we going to do?
You know, I don't know.
Thank you. Good night.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on this great show. You know, every family is in a unique position of some have more flexibility than others. Some have really little kids. Some are solo parenting. Some are in very actually dangerous positions. Some have kids who have learning needs, like learning needs that they need to be in school. And all of us didn't sign up for this when we had kids. Mm-hmm. Even the homeschoolers are like, dude, this isn't homeschooling, just so that we're clear, right? Because we keep calling it homeschooling and the homeschoolers are like, no, we like go leave the house. We do things. So we're all looking around hoping that the answers will kind of come. And I believe that schools are doing an amazing job. I mean, I really think that they're doing the best they can with a really tough lot. They had to pivot on a dime for online learning, and they have had the summer to find better platforms and I think more reasonable hours for the kids to be online. But all that being said, it's gonna be hard. I spoke yesterday to a woman, Laura Vanderkam, who wrote a quick digital book while in quarantine with five kids.
Oh.
The new corner office, how to work from home. And she kept saying something, though, that gave me, I guess, a sliver of hope. She kept saying, you know, learning to work from home with all their kids is a skill. And we're working on it. We're trying to get it right. And I thought, yeah, okay. That's a kind of forgiving way to look at it. Yeah, so it's going to be messy, but we can make a plan. We can start making a plan now to make it better.
Well, and I was going to say, so you're in Washington. Obviously, we are here in Charlotte where the public school system is going back August 17th, but going back is all virtual. So they're not going back. They're going all virtual. And I think one of the biggest things that all of us are dealing with, students and everyone that works in a school and certainly parents alike, is that so many of us thought, well, this was going to be temporary. I think everybody figured, you know, we get to June and then we'll start planning on, we'll have lockers and classrooms and sports and all those things. So maybe the first part is just dealing with kind of the mental weight of now knowing that you're not going back to school.
Yeah. And you know, I think it's interesting you mentioned that, because in the spring, part of all the psychic pain of this is in the spring, it was, well, just till April. Well, just till May 1st. Well, okay, now we're getting into mid-May, right? Like, there was this, everybody was on Tinder hooks, like, are we going back? It became pretty obvious, like, how? But again, I think you're right. We went through the summer with this hope. And we've watched things slide away, but I have been reading that mental health for kids and for adults is looking pretty grim right now. I think for many people, at least for me and my kids, is that we assume that we may not be going back this year. That's how I'm talking to the kids. And I talked to them since June, whenever virtual school let out, although one of my kids quit well before. She's like, I'm not doing this. I'm like 10-4. Okay. So I'm not going to force you to, because it's going to turn into like a child protective services issue. I'm saying that I think it looks like maybe the year inside. That's how I've been talking to them.
Let me flip it around too, because with a fair number of private schools, they are going back. And of course, that brings another set of issues and mental health challenges. Maybe we should have just called the show Mental Health 101, because that's really what we're dealing with here. But what are you hearing from clients, or just anecdotally, in terms of people who have children that are going back and they may be worried? I'm sure they are worried about potential virus spread and just the idea of going back.
You know, I have friends in states where they're going back in public schools 5 days a week full time. And my friends are not only not sending their kids, but not even participating in the virtual school. They're homeschooling, right? Because the virtual schools are just too heavy of a load for the little kids. We're talking 3 and 6, right? And a working mom. And her husband works outside the house and can continue to. It's just too much. Where's the homeschooling offers? I have friends with 2 kids in 2 different private schools. One of them is virtual. One of them is not. I have friends. Right, so what we have is, because we don't have any clear direction forward, this is not a political show, but it is what it is. There is a strong lack of leadership, period. And when you have that, you get a Lord of the Flies kind of feel, which is whatever works for me, right? It doesn't always bring out the best in humanity. So then you have podding, then you have hiring tutors, hiring teachers, hiring, right? I don't blame parents for any of that. I mean, everyone is trying to do the best they can and keep their job and not lose their minds. So, but there's resentment, there's jealousy, there's so much judgment. If you're going back, they judge people who aren't. If you're not going, it's a lot. A lot of judgment. And everyone, I do believe this, that everyone, even if I disagree with maybe what parents are doing based on science, or in some states, I should say what the states are doing, and everyone's doing the best they can.
Well, on that note, first message we have is from Mark on Twitter. Listener says, quote, "There is no perfect. Parents, give yourself grace. The time is different for all of us."
I mean, I can't even think. I just wrote a column yesterday for the Washington Post about how do we do this gracefully. And I looked up at the definition of grace, which is, one of the things I liked about it is that to move smoothly, which I had not thought of that that type of definition, but how do we move smoothly? And I think we need to lower our standards dangerously. I am the bear coach who's going to tell you organic nuggets.
Again, my guest is Megan Leahy. She is the author of the new book, Parenting Outside the Lines. And as she just mentioned, she is the On Parenting columnist at the Washington Post. And as I mentioned at the top, you are a parenting coach. And one of the things that gave me a chuckle in your book is that you said this is kind of a ridiculous made-up job title. So how does one become a parenting coach?
Oh, I just, you know, I made it up. No, I was a teacher for a long time. And then the kids kept asking me inappropriate questions. And I thought, you know, like, well, anyway, we won't get into that. It's a morning program. But they were middle school boys. And I thought, I think I should have a degree so I can answer these and not like get sued or something. So I went to Johns Hopkins and got my degree in counseling with a specialization in school. And then I thought, okay, I'll do that. And I hated it. I just kept talking to more adults. yeah, I seemed to be just a branch of how to get kids in trouble. I didn't like it. And then I started having my own kids. And I was like, whoa, 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 this is a mess. This is really hard. I started attending parenting classes, started volunteering with them. And then there is such a thing as getting certified as a parenting coach. I don't think I could do this job without my therapy degree, not because what I do is therapy, but because I can really quickly size up if I'm going to be able to help someone. So if you're clinically depressed, I don't really want to coach you until you help your depression, because I don't want to make you feel worse about your life.
So you can't work with anyone right now.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Oh, I was like, dude, kidding. I've never been busier. Just kidding.
And in terms of the title, Parenting Outside the Lines, I know what it means because I've read the book, but for people who are just new to this, what does it mean? What does it signify?
Well, it means that parenting in American culture, when I started writing the book, was pretty confusing. Now it's just who knows what's happening. But we seem to have, we're very trend and theory and expert driven. And I realized that I'm part of the problem. We seem to have lost the ability to trust our own intuition. We want answers and we want solutions and we want techniques. So do I. That's what the brain does. There's a problem, let's find a solution. Parenting doesn't tend to go like that. So I just wanted to write a book that asked the parents to more thoughtful questions about themselves, rather than here's a type of way to parent, do this to your kids. Right? Because a lot of parents I coach have adopted certain trends or theories. And I'm like,
there's no checklist for this?
No, kids are like hitting them with sticks. And the parents are like, you seem angry. What should we do? And I'm like, oh my Lord, what are we doing here, folks?
Again, my guest is Megan Leahy. If you want to participate in the conversation, tweet us at Charlotte Talks, email us charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're going to take a timeout here, but timeouts don't work. And Megan's going to tell you why timeouts don't work when we come back. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is Megan Leahy. She is the On Parenting columnist at the Washington Post, and she is the author of the new book, Parenting Outside the Lines. Before we go any further, I should have asked you at the beginning, you have three children. How old are your children?
16, 13, and 10.
So your elementary, middle, and high school, you've got every sector covered.
Three kids in three different schools.
And the coffee that you're drinking is not spiked, so that's impressive. Very good.
Not yet. No.
I mentioned as we were going to the break the notion of timeouts. I think anyone who has had children in recent memory has attempted the famed timeout as a way of coaxing a child to do what you want them to do. Why don't timeouts work?
You know, it's interesting. The person who created timeouts did not create them. The name escapes me. Psychologist, I think in the late 60s, early 70s, did not create them as this, like, stick a kid on a step for however many minutes the child is aged, right? You have a four-year-old, 4 minutes on a step. It was really to break up the action of whatever was happening and to kind of have the parent get down on the child's level, but it literally meant to just stop whatever was happening. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to, I guess, you know, the 90s and 2000s, we started sticking kids on steps and being like, stay there. And when you look at that out of the passion of the moment of you're just angry, you're not allowed to beat your kids anymore, which is highly effective, but also extraordinarily damaging. So, right. So parents didn't know what to do. So they stuck them on a step. And that is insane because you have a three-year-old and never have a three-year-old been like, wow, I'm on this step and I'm really thinking about it. I'm really thinking about it, where I went wrong.
It's a good time for self-reflection, right?
It's just not even possible. It's not neuroscientifically what is happening. What is happening is that they're either planning their escape, they're getting off the step and running away, which now you're chasing them. And that's to stick them back on the step, which never worked. And ultimately, you're creating more frustration in your relationship. So I'm just a big fan of not doing what doesn't work. It's just that's a double negative to say it doesn't work. Now, there's going to be some parents that are like, it worked for my kids. Awesome. Right? Like, I'm not going to say it never works. I'm just saying that I would say 99% of the time, you're not getting done what you think you are.
Reminder, parents out there that are listening, if you want to participate, you can tweet us at Charlotte Talks or you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. One of the things that you write about is that parenting culture in America is, relatively speaking, pretty new. And you were just mentioning, you know, that timeouts, for example, it's really only the past couple of decades. Along with the point that American parenting culture is fairly new, you also talk about the seismic shift of the women's liberation movement. All that is to say, is part of our, I guess, our confusion, part of our uncertainty in the United States about parenting due to the fact that we have so much that's both new and changed in a relatively short amount of time.
Absolutely. And it's I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, there is an ease in other cultures that have been just that culture forever and ever. There's a certain amount of ease in this is how we do things. You know, this is our basic religion. This is basically how families work. That's just passed down, and there's a lot of comfort and security in that. There's also a lot of dysfunction, and I'm sure a lot of people that are like, this isn't that great, just because we've always done it. And that being said, Americans, as we see right now on many levels, are a little bit of making it up as we go. But I think there's an opportunity to take the best of what everyone's doing and bring it in. You know, the beautiful thing about American families is every time people come together and create a family, you get to decide what you're going to do. You don't, you know, we are not a culture that it just clicks down one family after another necessarily. There's huge pockets of America that do and are, but you get to decide what you want to do. You get to decide if you're a family of faith or not. You get to decide what kind of school, what your priorities are, what your values are. A lot of places in the world, you don't have those choices. It's just what's done. So yeah, we're new. We're a mess. We're figuring it out. I hope I'm alive to see some of the good that comes of it. But already, even compared to my grandmother's generation, the change for women, it's huge.
Yeah, I'm curious, especially with your work as a columnist and obviously as a parenting coach, what are the gender dynamics right now? Are you hearing, 90% from moms? Are you hearing 50-50? Just where do things stand? How involved are dads in this equation? And I know I'm asking you to generalize, but...
Yeah. Dads have never been more involved as they are right now. They kind of have to be, they're there. So they'd really have to decide to run away into the woods and not parent or be a part of the family at this point. I've never seen as much fathering as I've seen now. Even just personally in my neighborhood, I've never seen as many fathers with their kids, walking, picking flowers, helping them ride a bike. And that's not a slam against the fathers. This is what time offers them, right? And we're not trying to shove it into a Saturday afternoon between soccer and right? Our time has become so compressed, and now we find pockets of time. I hear from a lot of dads sharing their favorite movies, or their, bonding over different things that just never would have come up. That being said, I am hearing from moms that they are feeling as crunched as ever. So if they were crunched before this, which I think it's fairly obvious that a lot of moms were carrying a lot of the family load and work, it's really now coming down on them in ways that feel pretty untenable. So I'm really trying to work on the partnerships, how that will look. But a lot of parents are working in tandem. The father will have the 3-year-old in the morning and the mom will have the 3-year-old in the afternoon so work can get done. It's a mess.
So, yeah, if you could say a prayer for the Spanberg daughters, because my wife is an essential worker, or her job is classified as essential. So she has been at the office the whole time. Yep. So they've been stuck with me, and they've now learned that my job consists of basically me sitting at a laptop and cursing at the laptop all day. So it's been a little bit humiliating. But
that's great.
I want to ask you one of the things that's interesting about your job, not only during the pandemic but just in general, is you're dealing with parents who are not only different faiths and different nationalities and different ages and all those things, but you're also dealing with that huge span of childhood. I can barely remember my children being little because they're teenagers now, and I'm worried about TikTok. You're dealing with that full span. So when you were working on this book, tell me a little bit about how you tried to balance those things of addressing issues that would appeal to the new parents as well as the more battle-scarred parents.
Yeah, it's both complicated, but not at all, because most of my work, really, the buck stops with how connected we are to them as the answer. So I tend to work with parents of littler kids because it's easier. You just don't have 7 years under your belt of you've done what to them? Okay. If I can get the parent of a 4-year-old, it's like, okay, here we go. We can, get some good work done.
Nice, clean canvas.
Totally. But even with the parents of older kids, there's always a way, because what everybody wants is, how can I start a behavior? How can I stop it? That's essentially it. That's why I get hired. That's why people buy parenting books. I want to stop things or I want to start things. And so I just always am flipping the perspective to, how can you connect and have a relationship with your child in which those things start to happen more naturally, right? Because coerciveness tends to not work well in humans.
Hard stop.
Right. And I want to just leave them with families where the kids come back home for Thanksgiving.
I think that's a reasonable goal. Again, my guest is Megan Leahy. She is the on-parenting columnist at The Washington Post. She is the author of a new book called Parenting Outside the Lines, and she is a parenting coach. I want to share a couple of things we've gotten from listeners. Let's start with Emily on Twitter, who says, during these trying times, how do you suggest explaining these complex emotional concepts to our little ones? I want them to fully comprehend. However, I don't want to traumatize or tell them too much.
That's a great question. Thank you. Here's the great thing about little kids. In their universe, there's you, the parent, or whoever is the caregiver, and then kind of everybody else. And all they really want to know is, are my caregivers okay? That's really it. So their okayness depends on your okayness. Now, as they get older and their social circles widen and their activities and interests, those losses are significant and felt differently. For little littles, yeah, they get bored. Yeah, they miss the rough and tumble of friendships and playgrounds. And of course, they miss their teachers. We've been, I think, surprised how much kids have missed their teachers. But they're going to be steady if we, the parents, are confident, strong leaders, full of compassion. They don't need that much. They really don't.
Don't overthink this.
Yeah. Yeah. Keep them busy. Run them like puppies.
We also have a pandemic puppy, so I'll be asking for counseling after the show on that one. from Diane in Charlotte, she says, I want to address the defensive feeling I have about judgment from others. My children will be returning to full-time school this fall. I'm satisfied that their school has the appropriate facilities and few enough students to make in-person school possible, and the policies they've created for mask wearing and distancing are ones I'm comfortable with. But I feel judgment from people when they hear our plan for the fall. For me, it's creating the same kind of mom guilt I had when they were in daycare as babies and toddlers. I thought that kind of judging was a thing of the past.
No, never. There's always more room for judgment.
It's a plentiful, bountiful commodity.
Oh my gosh. It is. So the first thing to remember about judgment is it's never personal. Even when it's personal, it's not personal. That person, the other person, is showing you how they feel about their own lives. And that's fine. And you don't need to accept that. You can just allow that person to have their feelings. If the conversation comes up, oh my God, my kids aren't going back. I can't believe it. Blah, blah, blah. What about yours? You can just say, it's been a really difficult decision. I'm really confident in the school's factor, like what they're doing to mitigate the virus. And we're going to move forward, fingers crossed. But it's been really hard for everyone, hasn't it? Right. So you just turn it back into a question while acknowledging that it's been difficult. And that's that. Don't let anybody abuse you about your decision, no matter what, unless, you know, you're doing something grossly wrong, in which the judgment will be swift from everybody. Just remember, it's not personal.
Again, if you'd like to participate, you can tweet us at Charlotte Talks, or you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Here's a really basic question from a clueless dad that happens to be talking to you this morning. Why do we all spend so much time talking about parenting with one another?
That's a good question. In the past, and I'm talking like centuries, you would be surrounded by your family, you would have all the generations with you, right? So family success was not moving away. And you would have like a wise person in the village, right? Like whatever. And there was just a more unified sense of what everyone was doing and far less insecurity because there was far less decisions, right? You had kids, so they'd work on the farm and get the food and build the stuff, and everybody died young and you just kept going, right?
How bucolic.
There just wasn't a lot of like, oh, you know, like imagining our lives. Okay. Fast forward through a lot, and our kids have more choice and more luxury than they've ever had. We also have a huge group of children that have no choice and no luxuries, right? And their parents are equally worried. But we feel, I think, this is my guess and some of what I read, I think we feel really disconnected sometimes. And the phones and technology don't help. And so we're always turning to each other like, hey, do you feel this way too? Hey, is that happening too? Because I think we lose community. We don't have that community. We don't, you know, we go into our houses, we shut the garage doors, and we live with our families. So every time I talk to someone and they're like, oh, my kid does this, I'm like, yeah, that's normal. I'm like, what? And it's kind of, it's sad because people, I think parents feel alienated and then all they turn to each other. And if you see something in the other person's like, no, my kid doesn't do that. Or my kid doesn't talk to me like that. That quiets us, right?
Well, you know, what will really concentrate and still the mind is a good dose of smartphones, iPads, technology. Mm-hmm. So Megan is going to solve all those problems in the span of about 17, 18 minutes. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks with Megan Leahy. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. And my guest today is Megan Leahy. She is the On Parenting columnist at the Washington Post. She is the author of the new book, Parenting Outside the Lines. And she is an officially certified parenting coach. You and Nick Saban. I mentioned as we were going to the break this little matter of technology. I'm sure you've never heard this before from any of your clients or any of your friends, but there are a few parents that occasionally get a little frustrated with the way their children use technology. And one of the things that's great about your chapter about this in the book is you start out by saying, okay, if we're going to talk about technology, let's talk about you. Look in the mirror, not Megan, but you, the parent. So why do you start there?
I start there because I am a hypocrite. I am a hypocrite about technology. I will yell at my kids about their
phone.
Hang on,
let me check my... Oh, go ahead. No, I'm sorry.
Totally. I will yell at my kids about their phone use while I am like playing a game called Wooden Block, which is like Tetris. I'm completely addicted. And I will be like, get off your phones. But I cannot stop playing Wooden Blocks. And this is where I just want parents to begin. I don't think we'll ever conquer the struggle, right? Because the people that develop apps are so much smarter than we are. They know what they're doing. We are just putty in their hands. But the more aware as a parent you can become of your own tech use, especially in front of your kids, the more legs you have to stand on for when you're going to be like, listen, this is how we're going to get this together in the house. And for some parents, I really do believe that depending on how their genetic makeup and their current mental health standing, that technology is making it worse or better, but in the pandemic, worse. I don't think parents always realize how much they are activating their depression and anxiety by pandemic scrolling. So I really want parents to take accountability for their own tech use. I'm not suggesting you're going to go like hermit. But just to not try to talk to people while you're also sending an email, a text, or candy crushing or whatever, right? Whatever you look at is what gets, is what you're paying attention to.
In part because adults are terrible at multitasking. my kids have let me know that. Yep. I want to ask you, I mean, you know, we could do seven shows on what age should a child be allowed to have a phone, or when should they be allowed to do social media, and all the potential pitfalls. But give us some sort of general guidelines as to how a parent can figure this out. You don't like to just give a checklist of answers, but you do like to help people search for their own answers. What are a couple of the questions that people should be asking themselves when they get into the tech arena?
Here's the funny thing, though. Look how subjective this is. If this had been a year ago, you know, I could rattle off APA standards, no tech for kids under, like, no screens for kids under two. Already, nobody does that, right? Very limited tech, no phones until a kid is, they say, 13. Okay. I just got an article today from a parenting tech expert that said no individual laptops for kids until they leave for until high school. What? How are we supposed to digitally learn? So the standards are kaput. Here is, though, what parents do need to be super aware of. Does your kid have an executive functioning issue and or ADD, ADHD? If the answer is yes, and also, by the way, all young kids have executive functioning issues. It's called their brains. If the answer is yes, these kids are more prone to getting sucked in and not being able to get off the technology. So you can, if you have multiple kids in a family, you will see it. And it's not about age. It's about the brain's ability to stop itself. So this is a sticky wicket. This is a mess. And parents right now are being told to help their kids stay on screens, sometimes like 3-4 hours, while also recognizing that when their kid tries to disconnect, you end up getting regressive behaviors, violence, anger, terrible screaming. I call it wired and tired. Like, they're both, and you've probably seen it in your own kids, right? That they can't bring their brain to a place of rest. They can't calm down, and you also can't get them to do anything else, right? Like, good, play this game, do this thing. I can't. Their brain is so hijacked by the chronic stimulation of technology. That's what I'm going to tell parents. Pay attention to your own kid and do what you need to do for them. So if the school's like, well, we're going to be doing this writing thing and it's going to be 3 hours, you're going to be like, no, dude, no. We're going to be taking like constant movement breaks, right? Jumping jacks, running around the house. You know, I have obstacle courses set up in my house that keep people run.
Keep them moving.
Yeah. Movement is the antidote to the tech brain.
Now, you'll love this, squirrel. So I'm going to get distracted by the tech behind me and share this message from Twitter from Ann Louise, who says, I have a second grader who struggled with online learning. She shut down often when something was hard. How can I get ahead of that frustration and encourage her to try without pushing too hard and causing conflict? I'm not above bribery. And this ties into your story about your own daughter, who I think was in finishing up fourth grade, and you had a situation where you just had to say, look, we're shutting this down. So.
Yes. So here's the beautiful thing. Now we generally, most parents know what they're headed into. So this is time for you to be proactive. I would definitely call the school right now and just say, this is what I'm looking at. What's going on? Who, like, school is still, like, the teachers and the specialized learner teachers, everybody's still there. Nobody's, like, off the earth, right? So contact your school, contact the specialists, and make your plan. It's not going to be perfect, but I'm looking at this as a gap year.
I like that. I think that's a very good way to look at it.
I mean, I have a junior in high school and I'm just like, it's going to be fine.
Yeah. Instead of Switzerland, you get your bedroom, you know.
Yeah. Everyone's going to be equally behind, but don't wait until school to start, for school to start. Don't wait to contact other adults. And also to start making plans with your kid about, like, here's the schedule that works for our family.
That's the voice of Megan Leahy. Again, she is the author of Parenting Outside the Lines, and she is the On Parenting columnist at the Washington Post. I want to share another listener comment with you. This parent says, I feel like we are trying to recreate a classroom at our house, but I worry that we aren't thinking outside the box enough, or that we're going to miss an opportunity to do something different that could be amazing. I'm just not creative enough.
Oh, snaps. Yes. Yes. And here's what's really hard. If you're working full time, how are you also supposed to sit there and be creative? Like, last I checked, I'm actually a teacher. I went to school for it. And I am a horrible teacher of my kids. It is, you know, the best homeschoolers and the people that are doing this really well are creative. They're going outside, they're using art, they're using music, they're using sports. So this is a time where go out and use other people's wisdom. There's websites called Tinker Garden. There's so many free resources, it actually boggles the mind. But start harnessing what other people are doing, because they're already doing it well. Don't recreate the wheel. So say, like, math lessons outside for a 8-year-old. You will get 180 ideas. Pick the one that speaks to you, right? Books, graphic novels for kids who love baseball, right? Just start compiling things. Definitely do not try and think of it yourself. Unless you like, that's your jam, then have at it. But it's not my jam.
I'm curious, you mentioned that you're a horrible teacher of your own children. They're old enough to know that you are what you do for a living. So I'm wondering how terribly impressed they are growing up with a parenting coach in the house.
Not. My older kids said they want to write a tell-all about living with me and go on a book tour. They say they're going to go to all the doctors, Dr. Oz, Dr. Phil. I'm like, hey, it's more press for me. Go ahead. No, they are not impressed. In fact, they always, if people knew, I'm like, what, that I'm human? Go ahead.
We're having them on tomorrow. But anyway, I want to share one more listener reaction. This is from Bridget, who says, I have 5 kids, all who have special education plans and receive intervention services for speech, occupational therapy, and counseling. My oldest son and my youngest son have one-on-one adult support in order to function in school. Obviously, I cannot recreate these resources at home. I feel our families are forgotten by society and the schools. We need community and school support services. I can't be a mom, teacher, speech therapist, occupational therapist, paraprofessional, and psychologist for multiple children simultaneously. There are many parents in my boat, and I think it warrants more discussion. What do you make of that?
I am speechless for Bridget, because I think they have been forgotten. The 504s and the IEPs, which are the, you know, different levels of, not diagnoses, but what goes into practice to help children with a variety of needs, from mental health to physical disabilities. There are children who are not able to learn at home because parents don't have support. And I don't know what the schools are supposed to do either. So I'm going to tell Bridget that she, again, has to do the best she can while not pushing, but strongly inviting the school to come together with these other parents who are in the same boat to find a way. I can't really speak to what that would look like based on safety during COVID and what that means for every family. But these children deserve to learn. They deserve to feel supported. They deserve to be with loving adults that can help them. And these parents deserve it too. They pay their taxes. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what this is about. So I'm going to, you know, say a little, whatever, prayer, hope that she will advocate, find her fellow parents and advocate for support in whatever way that looks like. Lots of naps are needed. And, you know, we will get through this. And so my hope is on the other side that at least moms and parents like Bridget can find a lot of self-compassion, because you cannot do all of this. It's just not reasonable.
I want to ask you about something that applies to both the pandemic era that we're living in, or any time, which is the advice that you give parents is, and this is included in the book, you have a lot of questions to get people thinking, is to write down what you need to do, what you want to do, how you're feeling about your parenting techniques. And I'm wondering how hard it is to convince people to do that, because as we just alluded to 1,000 times, people are pressed for time, they're tired, all those things. But clearly you see a lot of value in this. So how do you make the case that, yes, it's worth picking up pen and paper and putting this down, putting these thoughts down?
They largely ignore me.
That's a repeat customer.
I know. That's how I keep them coming back. So the best I can do is I physically make, when I coach people, write down on stickies what their homework is to hang everywhere. And then like I go with them and I'm like, put this in your bathroom, put this in your kitchen, put this in your car. Because or I watch them put it into their phones as an alert. Yeah. So I love handwriting because I do think it activates a part of the brain that is not activated normally with typing. But alerts in your phone are beautiful. So as soon as the parent wakes up, they get an alert that's like, don't fight with your kid about oatmeal. Remember, you're doing this instead, right? So that's how that works. I hopefully say it enough that even if they write in a margin, even if they scribble a note, it gets in there differently. Yeah. I don't know.
And so in the 30 to 45 seconds we have left, what piece of advice would you leave parents with as we come into, as I mentioned at the top, this bizarre return to school that we're facing?
Remember that the connection with your kids is the most important. You want to come out of this all still loving each other. Academics are skills that can be learned at any point. Of course, you're going to watch some kids falling behind, but what we need to do is come together and help those most endangered. And keep a sense of humor. We can laugh still.
Megan Leahy, it's been such a pleasure to have you today. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Be safe.
Megan Leahy is the author of Parenting Outside the Lines, and she is the On Parenting columnist at The Washington Post. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Thanks for joining us. Mike will be back tomorrow with the News Roundup.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.